Well, thank you very much, John Evans, for agreeing to the interview. So my name is Bernard John, and my colleague here is Angela King. So we're doing the interview for the Caldecott Intergenerational Oral History Project. So I'll ask you some questions, personal questions about where were you born, John?
I was born in Neath, Neath in South Wales, that is, at the very end of 1938. My parents were colonial types, and it happened that we were on leave, they were on leave, from East Africa at the time. But they were a Neath family, both my father and my mother. And I was born, and the intention was that we were, as a family, my brother, who was a year plus older than I was, we were intending to return to East Africa at the time. My father was a colonial servant, and he was attached to the railways in East Africa, and it was a reserved occupation, so he had no choice but to go back. Mm-hmm. But because I'd been born, my mother was going to follow him, mm-hmm. not go with him at the time in 1938.
Mm-hmm. And so she was going to follow him to East Africa?
Yes.
So is that what she did?
Yes, what happened was one of these extraordinary stories, because about 6 months later, so when I was about 6 months, my brother was 18 months or so, the three of us set off from Portsmouth, taken down there by her, my mother's family, set off intending to go through the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal. Back to Dar es Salaam in East Africa, or actually back to Tanga at that time, because that's where they were living then. However, as the ship set off from Portsmouth, it hit a mine, and it was one of our own mines, and it meant that the ship had to return very smartly, but the family, meanwhile, had returned to South Wales. So my mother was dumped back on the quayside in Portsmouth with no family. They'd gone. The police, she got in contact with the docks police, and the police said, "Have you got any relations here?" Because don't forget, this is the time when even telephones, ordinary land telephones, were not easy to get hold of or to use. And cut a long story short, she remembered that they had a cousin living in Southsea, I think it's called, which is the other side of Portsmouth. And the outcome was that they made contact for her, and within about a day and a bit, they'd located her, and the family, three of us, ended up with Hetta, she was called, Hetta Causey. And it was arranged then that she'd get back to South Wales. And of course this was by train then. And this now was mid-1939. And so the war that had been expected, shall I say, was now looming ever closer. And mother was told that she wouldn't be able to go back to Africa. But she was a very strong-minded person, and she caused a big fuss. And eventually, the three of us set off again. Only this time, it was from Liverpool to Boston, Boston to Rio, Rio to Cape Town, and then transship
overland.
No, up on a coast.
Yeah,
around to Dar es Salaam. I don't know how long it was, but I can imagine it must have been a pretty difficult trip with a baby and a toddler.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was what my mother was like.
And in all this time, your father was
in
East Africa.
East Africa, yeah, working for the railways. East African Railways, which, ironically, of course, had been not necessarily set up, but they'd certainly been improved by the Germans during the period when that whole part of East Africa had been a German protectorate. And it was part of the settlement, I suppose is the word, after the First World War, that Britain got Kenya, Tanganyika and Uganda. And other bits was split up among the other allies.
So. And your father, was he an administrator or was he an engineer? Or?
He was an administrator. He'd started his working life as a management apprentice for the GWR in South Wales, based, it was a, as I understand it, there was an office somewhere between Swansea and Neath. But as was the requirement with the GWR, they insisted that all apprentices had to spend some time in the workshop in Swindon. So not only from then, but certainly that meant that although my father was on the administrative side throughout, he always really wanted to be an engineer.
Did he? So, so this is very early on in your life. I take it you don't remember very much about that.
Well, the family are very surprised by the things that I do remember, because it was a period where, from when I was coming up to one, up until we had to stay there through the war, and so we didn't leave until 44. But two of the things that I particularly remember was that in due course, I went to school in a convent run by some sisters. There weren't many schools in those days dealing with European children. In fact, there weren't that many European children anyway. So I remember that, and I remember particularly a sister called Sister Silana. I don't know what her nationality would have been, but it wouldn't be too surprising if she was a German as well. Because, of course, there were a lot of Germans still living in East Africa. And German citizens. That's one thing I remember. The other thing I remember is where our house was. I found it on a map. I Googled it the other day. Gerizani Avenue in Dar es Salaam. By this time, they'd moved from Tanga to Dar es Salaam, which was the sort of main railway workshops and huge marshalling yards. But that part of East Africa was rather strange because there were three railway lines that went from the coast up over the escarpment to the plateau inland, one from Dar es Salaam, which was the main one, another one from Mombasa, and another one from Tanga. And those three towns were all ports. So everything that got into East Africa arrived in those ports, and then it was carried by the railways up country. And one of the things, as I say, that I remember when I must have been four, I suppose, something like that, was standing on a little bridge looking down at the railway line with trains going out from underneath, heading up into the hinterland.
Mm-hmm.
We, like a lot of kids at that time, we had pretty free time, and we were put in charge of the older children of our house servants. Either the, in Africa they were called armors, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I confuse this slightly because of later life. But they had a family of their own, and they lived in the sort of servants' quarters behind the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And the teenagers, male or female, would look after us after school or whatever. So I'm sure that I'd been on this little railway bridge with one of the boy children of our servants.
Mm-hmm.
And were they those children that looked after you? Were they? Would you see them as friends at that time, do you think?
Yes, very much. You know, there's quite a story behind all this, because my parents were both Neath people, and they were at Neath Grammar School together, and they were very keen sports people, and so they were in various teams, and my mother was staunchly socialist, and my father was the leading light in the local Conservatives. And people in Neath still remember this and laugh about it. But the it was my mother's influence, I think, particularly, meant that you know, we treated as a family, unlike quite a lot of the other expats. We always treated our people, you know, it's not acceptable these days, but the senior man was always called the house boy. But
to put a word into your mouth, a paternalistic approach, would you say?
It was generally, yes. And later in my life, I've got some anecdotes to tell you about that later on.
So when you, 1944, you returned, the family returned to the UK, and you would have been about five at that time. Six,
well,
my
birthday is right at the end of 38. In effect, I was born in 1939.
Yeah, yeah.
So by that time I was five.
Five, okay. Yeah. So what do you remember of coming to the UK, which for you at that time would have been something completely new out of your experience?
Yes and no. I mean, during the war, we used to listen as a family to the radio on shortwave. And so basically we knew what was going on. And places like Dar es Salaam were staging posts for various parts of the services who were trained in South Africa and went up to the Eastern Med, where they were, you know, they were in Palestine, they were in Egypt, fighting all around those places. So we had quite a lot of contact as a family with service people. There were no hotels in the sense that there are now. And so a lot of the young pilots used to stay with families, and they certainly used to come and you know, have meals, and we'd go out on a little boat and on weekends, that kind of thing. So we weren't totally unaware of what was going on at the other end of the world, as it were.
And sharing the culture that was still,
that's right,
back from the UK.
Very much an established colonial culture, where, of course, the governor was the king's representative at that time. And any kind of dealings with Government House was like a mini Buckingham Palace. And, you know, it was extraordinary.
So when you came back, what was not quite the end of the war, but within months of the war ending, to come to an end. So
I will tell you about the trip home, because
you
realise that we left before the war had actually ended.
Yes.
Certainly the war in Japan was still going on.
Yes.
And we must have left East Africa on a smaller boat, the B&I line.
What is the B&I line?
B&I was something in India. British, or something like that.
Mm.
It was later taken over by P&O.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And we were on what was in peacetime a mixed cargo vessel, had a few passengers, but it also had a 6-inch gun on the poop. And at noon every day, the crew used to throw over a marker, a buoy, and the ship steamed on for a given distance. And then this gun was shot at the target to keep everybody in trim.
Hmm.
And when that gun went off, the whole ship used to shudder,
mm-hmm.
because it really wasn't a battleship. It wasn't intended to be that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we went up through that side of the Indian Ocean, through the Red Sea, through the canal, no particular problems. But when we got into the Mediterranean, the war was still on,
mm-hmm.
but the Mediterranean was more or less deemed safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were heading back towards Liverpool, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to us on the boat, a submarine followed us in through the torpedo nets, through the submarine nets.
Mm-hmm.
And he got into the main harbour and he was shooting off his torpedoes just to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he surfaced and surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
But I do distinctly remember the explosions,
mm.
because on a ship, you know, the whole thing mm. shakes again.
Mm.
When these torpedoes were just hitting the quay walls and things like that. They weren't sinking ships as it happened.
Mm.
So you can see that was still wartime.
Yeah. So had they drawn the nets back to let you in and he followed?
Yes, several. everybody went in convoys mm. and they must have drawn them back to let a mini convoy in, and the submarine followed
mm.
the convoy in.
Mm.
Bit of a lapse of concentration, I suppose. But again, don't forget that there wasn't the technology in those days there is now.
Mm. And the end of the war was in sight.
Yeah.
And the captain of the U-boat could see that and was going to do something for his country before it was all over.
Yeah. And so the war actually finished in the time that we were going then from Gibraltar to Liverpool.
Mm.
And again, you know, I don't particularly recall that.
Mm.
But we arrived back in Neath, and we were all the family now, my father, mother, and my brother and myself. And we arrived back in Neath, I think it must have been midsummer.
Mm.
1945.
Mm.
The family kindly put us up. My grandmother lived in Neath, and my father's family were also there. So, you know, they were welcomed back into the Neath crowd. But this was only a leave on service. It wasn't that we were back and that was finished.
Mm-hmm.
My father was still a colonial servant.
Mm-hmm. So turning to Neath for a moment, I know things moved on from there. And Neath is, I don't know to what extent it was a Welsh-speaking area. Did your grandparents, were they Welsh speakers?
No, neither of them.
No.
Neath was, as soon as you moved up the valleys, you got into Welsh speaking.
Yeah.
Mm.
But most people in Neath spoke English.
Yeah.
And you know, this my family, there were Welsh speakers in the family, but schooling and everything else was all in English at that time.
So you're back home in Neath.
Yeah.
And continued your education in Neath.
Well, what happened there was that my father's sister had been the, they called them the babies class teacher in the Knoll School in Neath forever, from the time that she finished her training, and she was still there. And she managed to get us into the Knoll School for a few months, because by this time Father had been up to the Crown agents, because although they were colonial servants, the Crown agents did all the administration for all the British colonies, and that was in Millbank. And he was told, he wasn't asked, he was told that he's had to go to North Borneo. And the reason was twofold. One was that he was a railway man, and there was a small railway in the from the capital up country. But also it was because the people who had lived in North Borneo before the war and didn't get out had all been interned, and the idea was to replace them as soon as possible so that they could come back, literally, for not just rest and recuperation, but actually you know, to recover their health and spirits.
So for the listener who may not be familiar, so they were interned by the Japanese?
Yes. And the infrastructure of that part of the of what was then called British North Borneo, it's now called Sabah for this record. It's part of Eastern Malaysia. You have Sabah and Sarawak in Eastern Malaysia, and then you have the peninsula. The fighting, first of all, when the Japanese invaded and the British stroke Australian forces were forced out, and then later at the end of the war when the Australians and even Americans came back to recapture it, all the infrastructure had been badly damaged. There was an aerodrome, but it was a grass strip, and it was full of bomb craters and wrecked planes and things. And on the railway, which was 120 miles of meter gauge, there were, I think, four major river crossings, major for that kind of railway, and those had all been blown out. And when the Australians came back in, they'd replaced some of those crossings with Bailey bridging, but of course it wasn't actually proper bridging.
Not a permanent solution.
Temporary bridging. It wouldn't carry the locos, for instance. Yeah. It could carry trucks, but not locos.
Yeah. Mm. So he went to Borneo. Did the family go with him?
Yeah, we all went.
Yeah.
And this time we left from Tilbury, and we went, you know, Bay of Biscay, Gibraltar, Suez Canal, that way, and it took, I think, something like 6 weeks to get to Singapore.
Yeah.
And this was on a boat called the TSS, which meant in those days twin screw steamer, Empire Brent. So it was one of these ships that took the 10-pound pommies. But of course, at this time in must have been very late 45 or early 46, I think we got to Singapore in January or February 46. It was still a troop ship, because it was taking troops out as well to replace the others.
Mm.
And the women and young children were on the top two decks, and the men and the troops were on the lower three decks.
Mm. Mm.
And Father, being a experienced colonial, the first thing he did when we got onto this boat in Tilbury was that he said to my mother, stay with the boys here, and I'm going to go and find the steward and organise our accommodation.
Clever.
Yeah, and anyway, we ended up in a cabin at the waterline level, deck F, and this was a long, narrow cabin, but it did have two portholes.
Mm.
And in peacetime, it would have had possibly two, maybe three sailors in it.
Mm.
But for this trip, it had been divided into three spaces.
Mm.
And the innermost one had four bunks.
Mm.
And then there was a partition, and then there were another four bunks.
Mm.
And then there was a partition. Then there were two bunks by the side of the ship, by the hull, with the portholes.
Mm.
And Dad managed to organise it so that my brother and I were in the two, and he was in the top bunk, in the first of the other things.
Mm.
We had to obey all the meal times, and it was only during day times that we could meet up with Mother, because she was upstairs with the women and children.
Yeah.
And again, Father, being an experienced colonial type, he had also bagged a space on the deck, which we put our towels down. and all the way out to Singapore, you know, we had this this little space at the top of a gangway on the boat deck.
Oh,
and we repelled all boarders, except for a young couple that we made friends with.
Yeah.
He was a young district officer heading out to Malaysia, and he was newly married.
Mm.
So he and his wife and the three of us, the three men, boys, you know, we used to be on this space whenever we could possibly be out on deck.
Mm. Mm. So this is, again, for the benefit of the listener, so this is before VJ Day, this is before the war with Japan had ended.
It must have been, we must have left before it started, because VJ Day is August, isn't it?
Yeah, in 46, is that
46,
right?
yeah. No,
45.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry. The war had finished.
It had finished.
Yes, it must have finished before we left. We left at the end of...
Yeah.
Well, I happen to know. I'd said Tilbury. I'd have to correct that.
Mm.
We left from Port Glasgow.
Mm.
And the ship was sailing on the 28th of December, 45. Now, I remember that.
Yeah.
Particularly because it's my birthday.
No. Oh.
And we travelled up from Neath by train, which took something like, 18 hours, change of crew, you know, and this was the darkest part of the year. And even that, there's another story there, because we were dumped in Central Station in Glasgow, and because we were going for what would be 3 or 4 years, we had a lot of luggage.
Mm.
And this stuff was all tipped out on the platform there, and everybody said, you're on your own. So Father went out into the street, and he was waving pound notes until he found a chap with a lorry. And he said, can you get us down to Port Glasgow with these packing cases? And again, one of my abiding memories there was we got into this transit shed, and it was so cold. And of course, in those days, as youngsters, we wore shorts.
Mm.
And my legs and my feet were like ice.
Mm.
But anyway, we did get aboard.
Mm.
And another little thing was that part of the family had arranged, was it called family favourites?
Remember?
Yeah.
And what part of the family had arranged for me, you know, to have some music on that time. And I remember it was Greensleeves.
Mm. Oh, Cliff Michelmore, wasn't it?
That's right.
And his wife, yes. Yeah.
And we were taken into the Radio Shack to listen to this, yeah. My father and myself, my brother.
We should again explain to the listener what Family Favourites was.
It was a radio programme. You know, we're not talking about television. This is all pre-television.
Yeah, yeah.
But people could send in requests for music of some kind to be played for a special occasion.
Yeah, for people who were stationed overseas.
No, it wasn't. It was
anybody.
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 I mean, the forces used to use it, didn't they?
Yeah,
yes,
they did.
That was Sue-way Family Favourites,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay, John, so now you're in Borneo.
Well, we've got to Singapore.
Oh, you got to Singapore, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we had to transship to a smaller vessel, which is the coaster that goes up from Singapore around Sarawak and around Borneo. And back, it goes back and forward, back and forward. And that was something like another 10 days. Was called at several places on the way. And that was a line called the Straits Steamship Line, and a vessel called the Darvel. Darvel was, I think, must have been one of the early either Colonial Office or East India Company, more likely, senior people. Everything was named after people from either the administration or the East India Company.
Mm.
And anyway, after calling at, I think we called Kuching, Labuan, and then Jesselton, which was the capital, which was where we were going.
Mm. So you arrived.
So we arrived.
And this time you are... 7 or 8 years?
No, maybe? five and a bit.
5 and a bit, okay.
If you think about it.
For 38 to 45.
Well,
yes.
Make it 39 to 45.
39 to 45, yeah.
Because it was right at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have a clear recollection of arriving there?
Very much.
Yeah.
My recollections from there on are very bright.
Yeah.
Everything that happened over the next, I think we were there for 3.5 years.
Mm.
The tour was extended slightly.
Mm.
Father, because of the circumstances, he was head of department.
Mm.
He wouldn't have been if it had been normal time, because somebody would have been appointed from the UK with more senior expertise, because it was going to be an engineering job rather than an administrative job.
Mm.
But basically he was acting general manager at that time.
Mm.
And the people who had been there and had been interned, they were the ones who had to go back, back to the UK or back to Australia.
And these were the more experienced people. Including the more experienced people.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
The senior man would have been my father's superior had he stayed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were back to education.
Well, that's another story. And the thing was that at that time, the only two European boys in the whole colony were my brother and myself.
Yeah.
And there was no... established school for the likes of us, and the only school in Jesselton, the capital, was the Convent of the Sacred Heart, which was run by some Dutch Jesuits for the boys and for some Carmelites for the girls. And so Mother, as I've already said, you know, was fairly social-minded. And she said, you know, you've got to go to this school. And of course, it was very interesting because North Bornu at that time was rather unusual. There was a real mix of people there. The indigenous tribes were still tribal. And there were Dusun farmers, there were Murut hillsmen, there were Dayak headhunters, stroke fishermen, stroke whatever. And then there were the Chinese who had been there forever. You know, they used to laugh at the British administration. And they had things like pepper plantations. And of course, they survived the war and the internment pretty well. And then there were the Malays. Not so many of them that I remember at that time, because of course this was still colonial era before independence. And then there were a lot of subcontinental people, Anglo-Indians, Anglo-Bangladeshi, but of course it hadn't become that at the time. We had a lot to do with them because of course they were railway people from India. And they were the ones who, you know, my father's office, for instance, all the engineering side were the subcontinental Anglos. The clerks were largely Chinese. There weren't many Malays because the Malays were rather aloof. You know, they'd been the royalty, particularly on the peninsula. But in this school, there was all this mix. And although it was clearly a Catholic Christian foundation, because it was in a British colony, they understood that they were having to be even-handed with all these different people. And the two of us had the most marvellous education. English was the common language of the school, at the teaching, but all these other people spoke their own languages. And when we were, you know, playtime or anything like that, you can imagine we had to learn Malay pretty quickly, because that was the lingua franca of the general population. The teaching, you might say it was fairly basic, but it was very disciplined. And we weren't taught maths. We were taught arithmetic, geometry, and algebra. And of course we had what was called religious studies. Not religious instruction, it was called
religious education.
Religious education. The outcome of all the Dutch, particularly in the East Indies, meant that there were a lot of Christians in this total population. Even now, I've been back fairly recently, and even now in East Malaysia, in what's now called Sabah, there are 70% of the people who say they're Christian. Although it's a Muslim state now. In Sarawak there are more Muslims, and of course on the mainland they are predominantly Muslim. You know, the history of that whole end of the world is quite extraordinary.
You said at the beginning of this recollection of your early days there, that the Chinese who'd been there throughout the war and before laughed at the British administration. Why did they laugh at it?
Well, our particular Chinese friends, a chap who became the first foreign minister of the combined state, a chap called Ong Ki Kwan, he used to pull my father's leg and say, "We've been trading here and exploiting these people for 3,000 years, and you come along and try to impose order on them all, and it's doomed to failure." So, you know, it's interesting to think about this kind of thing.
Yes, it is. And so the British colonial impulse was to do what you've just described, to Christianize.
Well, no, not to Christianize, but a horrible word, to civilize.
Civilize, yeah. And as you saw it, yeah.
Yeah, and
as we saw it.
The most extraordinary part about it is that the colonial administration, right from its beginning, had this one aim, as I understand it, I'm not an expert,
yeah.
But as I understand it, they had this aim to educate, civilize, whatever the word is, these populations to facilitate the trade with Britain.
Yeah.
And of course, people will now say to exploit their resources and exploit the people.
Yeah.
All I can say is that my experience was rather different. It was the time, if you think about it, this was the time when the Labour government here were deciding that they couldn't afford to keep the colonies, and they were determinedly giving them all back and wanting them to become independent.
Yeah.
And the way I see it, and I'm sure that other people will take issue with me on this, but the way that I see it was that this mix of culture and race didn't really want the British to go from that part of the world, North Borneo, because we were a stabilizing influence.
Mm.
Whereas the moment the British pulled out, there would be this fractional friction, let's call it, war, between the various ones who thought that they could do better for themselves, should I say.
Mm, I understand that.
I'm not being, I'm not trying to be in any way judgmental about this.
Mm.
It's just as I saw it.
Yeah.